Thank you. Great to be here, and I hope to see you all in person next spring, next fall, I guess. Okay, so yeah, and please feel free to interrupt me with questions during the talk. You don't have to wait to the end. So in my branch of kinetics metaphysics, usually the kind of questions we're interested in is the properties of quantum many-body systems. We have some system of quantum degrees of freedom in the thermodynamic limits, or infinitely many degrees of freedom. So often you imagine, for example, electrons hopping between atoms and interacting with each other. So we seem to have some kind of locality structure. So the Hamiltonian would only couple, the terms in the Hamiltonian would only couple local degrees of freedom. And then the question is, what is the nature of the physics of a system, at low temperatures and at long length scales? Like, viewed on length scales, much longer than the lattice spacing. Maybe to phrase it another way, you can think of the relations of the renormalization groups. So, at the macroscopic scale, you have a lattice Hamiltonian. And then, in some coarse graining transformation, gives you the effective field theory that defines the physics at low energies and long wavelengths. And so, we would like to understand, what the nature of this effective field theory could be for, some given lattice Hamiltonian. So there's really two qualitatively different regimes that could arise. You could have a gapless system or a gap system. So a gap system is where, so here's the energy spectrum, you have the ground state, and if there's a gap, non-zero gap, that remains non-zero even if in the thermodynamic limit, we say a system is gapped. And if a gapless system, there will be some tower of gapless states that goes all the way down to the ground state. So if you want to understand the low energy physics of a gapless system, it's going to be described by some kind of scale invariant quantum field theory at low energies and long wavelengths. Could be a conformal field theory, although of course scale invariance doesn't always imply conformal invariance. And so there's lots of interesting non-trivial scale invariant quantum field theories that we think about in kinetic matter systems that could arise. But that's not what I'm going to talk about in this talk. I'm going to focus on this gap case. And so in the gap case, we're imagining that we're thinking at low temperatures. So temperatures much below the gap. So the all these excited states really are frozen out at low temperatures. You're really only talking about the ground state. And then we think about what kind of non-trivial features could this ground state have. And so in the if the analogous statement to this one about conformal field theory is that the non-trivial features of the ground state were described by topological quantum field theory, because in a gap system, there's no dynamical degrees of freedom at low temperatures, so it would be a topological quantum field theory. Okay, but that's much higher level of abstraction than what I want to discuss in this talk. Topological quantum field theory is a difficult subject. It's not the perspective I will take in this talk. There are more concrete ways to understand the non-trivial aspects of these gapped ground states. But what I do want to say is that these gap ground states can host topological phases of matter. So topological phase of matter, basically what you mean, so we imagine this is some phase diagram system. So we imagine some variance, some parameters of the macroscopic Hamiltonian. And they say we have some regime where it's gapped. So that will define a topological phase. And then there can be a different topological phase. And then the topological phases number two and number three, for example, are distinct in the sense that if you try to continuously tune the parameters of a Hamiltonian to get between them, you'll cross through a phase transition. And in fact, there's something about these two topological phases that make them like fundamentally distinct, such that it's impossible to go from one to the other without going through a phase transition, no matter what kind of path you take. And so this phase transition, you can kind of think of it as a point where the Hamiltonian becomes gapless. So you have these gapped regimes, but they're separated by intermediate gapless regime. So then we can ask, what is so fundamentally distinct about these two different topological phases that makes them so different that they can only be connected through a phase transition? So that's, a question that we'll talk about today. And so one way that a topological phase can be non-trivial is that it can be fractionalized. So fractionalized topological phases are also called non-invertible or long-range tangled topological phases. But I won't use these terminologies in this talk. It's a bit obscure for the uninitiated. I think fractionalized probably reflects better what the physics of these phases are. So fractionalized topological phases have non-trivial fractionalized excitations. So what do I mean by fractionalized excitations? So as I said, at low temperatures, we're basically just talking about the ground state. But now we can consider a different state, which is a localized excitation on top of a ground state. So this state is some state that looks the same as a ground state everywhere, except in some local region. So something is happening in that local region, away from the local region, it just looks like the ground state. So I want to emphasize it. This is not an eigenstate of a Hamiltonian. That's not the way we're thinking about it. It's just any state that is obtained from the ground state by adding something locally. That's what we call a localized excited state. And then the definition of fractionalized excitation is it's a localized excitation that cannot be created locally. So even though this localized excitation has the property that you can't see it except in this local region, there's no local operator actually just in the vicinity of this local region that will relate this excited state back to a ground state or vice versa. So you cannot create or destroy this excitation locally, even though its signature, its presence is only there locally. So that's a fractionalized excitation. And then there's lots of interesting things that can happen when you have these fractionalized excitations. But first, maybe let me just say, if you can't create it locally, then how do you create it? Well, the idea is that each fractionalized excitation comes with some kind of antiparticle. So you can compare, you can create a particle-antiparticle pair locally. And then once you've created this particle-antiparticle pair, you can move them apart. And so once you've moved them apart, they look like localized excitations, but you didn't create them locally. You created them together and then moved them apart. And so there's various interesting properties of these fractionalized excitations. For example, they can carry fractional charges under global symmetries. Like let's say you have, for example, a U1 symmetry, so conservation of charge, and the fact that it's U1 tells you that the charge is quantized. Then normally you would say that the charges can only be a multiple of E, the fundamental charge for that U1 symmetry. But actually in these fractionalized excitations, they can carry fractional charges under that global symmetry. So why is this allowed? It's only allowed because they're fractionalized, because the fractionalization means that you can only create an A particle if you create an A bar at the same time. And so then the fractional part of a charge can cancel out between these two, and the total charge of a system is still an integer. So that's why it's not violating the conservation of the quantization of charge in the whole universe. But if you just look at a single excitation, locally, it looks like it carries this fractional charge. And then there's also various interesting things about these fractionalized excitations. They can have non-trivial exchange statistics. So, normally you think of particles can only be fermions or bosons, but in two dimensions, you can have more exotic possibilities. Like you have particles that you exchange them, you don't get just +1 or -1, you get some other phase factor. And then it's also associated with braiding statistics, where you move a particle around the other particle and it's gives you an non-trivial phase factor, which for bosons and fermions would never happen. So that's allowed in 2D in theory, but if you have our real universe, which is only made out of bosons and fermions, it's still allowed, but only if these particles are fractionalized excitations that cannot be created locally. And so this would be an emergent property of some topological phase. And indeed, these fractionalized excitations can be experimentally realized. A very famous example is a fractional quantum Hall effect, which is a two-dimensional electron system in a strong magnetic field. And it indeed has these excitations to carry charge E over 3. So it's almost like you've broken the electron up into parts. Okay, but I'm actually not going to talk too much more about fractionalized topological phases in this talk. I was just introducing this in order to tell you what I'm not talking about. I will instead focus on so-called unfractionalized topological phases. These are topological phases that maybe still be non-trivial, but not non-trivial in the sense that they have these fractionalized excitations. Okay, so I will talk about unfractionalized topological phases. And these are also called invertible topological phases, so short-range entangled topological phases. But again, I will not use that terminology here. Unfractionalized is really telling you the most physical thing about what they are. This notion of an unfractionalized topological phase also has a large overlap with the concept of symmetry protected topological phases, in case that's a big buzzword lately, in case you've heard it. And the prototypical example of the unfractionalized topological phase is this integer quantum Hall effect. So this is kind of a simpler version of the, I mentioned already, the fractional quantum Hall effect. but this is a simpler version of it that was discovered first. So again, it's an electron gas in a strong magnetic field. And so now let's talk about the resistivity of the system. So the resistivity relates to the electric field and the current. So in general, it can be some tensor. And in two dimensions, it would be a 2x2 matrix. And if you impose enough symmetry, like rotational symmetry, then there's only two independent components, the diagonal component, which we call rho xx, and the off-diagonal component, which we call rho xy. And rho xy is also called the Hall resistance. That's why it's the quantum Hall effect. And so if you measure these things experimentally in some two-dimensional sample, you get some interesting behavior going on. So here's the Hall resistance, rho xy. And as a function of magnetic field, you get these plateaus. And the values of the Hall resistance of these plateaus is very interesting. It's actually related to these fundamental constants. So there's this fundamental constant of resistance, E squared over 2 pi h bar, which is about 26,000 ohms. And then if you measure the value for Hall resistance of these plateaus, you see it's just some fraction of the this fundamental resistance constant. So these plateaus is really reflecting the values of fundamental constants. And in fact, this relation with this fundamental constant is true to a very high degree of precision, like some very large number of decimal places. So I would say that you could use this to measure a very accurately Planck's constant, although of course in the new SI units, Planck's constant actually has an exact value. So now the statement would be, since the mass in the, since kilogram in SI units is defined in terms of Planck's constant, you can use these plateaus to very accurately calibrate measurements of mass, which indeed is how it's done these days in the new SI units. So what is going on in this system that gives rise to these incredibly well quantized plateaus? Firstly, let me just mention that in these plateaus, the system is gapped. So we're in the regime of these topological phases. And indeed, these quantized values of Hall resistance will somehow be related to properties of a topological phase. So let me talk about the conductivity tensor. It's just the inverse of the resistivity tensor I had on the previous slide. So it's relation between current and electric field. So the experimental fact about the integer quantum Hall effect is that in the integer quantum Hall effect, the conductivity tensor looks like this. Its diagonal component is actually zero, as you might expect, because the system is an insulator if it's gapped. But it has its off-diagonal components that is proportional to an integer. And here I've gone to units in which e equals h bar equals one to make things simpler. So if I introduce the Levi-Civita symbol in 2D, I can write the conductivity tensor like this. So if I substitute into the equation for the current in terms of the field, I get this relationship between the current and the electric field. So it looks like this, and proportional to this integer m. Now there's actually another equation I can derive from this one, which is that the charge density is related to the magnetic field. Now, of course, I can combine both of these two equations into a single Lorentz invariant equation. So here I have Levi-Civita symbol. Now it's in 2 plus 1D space-time. F is the electromagnetic field strength tensor. J mu is the current in space-time. So the time component is the charge density. So let's look at some features of this equation. First of all, it's topological. This equation does not depend on the metric. It's invariant under arbitrary drifting motions in space-time, and it doesn't depend on the metric at all. That's what we mean by topological. In particular, of course, it's a scale invariant. I mean, that's a consequence of diffeomorphism invariance, which makes sense because we're talking about just the properties of the extreme low temperature limit of a system. So there's there shouldn't be no scales left in the system. It's non-distributive, so because basically the electric field is going perpendicular to the current, so the work done by the electric field is always zero. And then I mentioned this before, the coefficient of this response is quantized. So before I introduce this as an experimental fact, in a minute I'll give you the theoretical argument for why it had to be true. But the general point I want to make is that, so for a gapped quantum system, at low temperatures, there's no dynamical freedoms, there's no dynamical degrees of freedom left. So you might have thought that there should be just no response at all. But actually, you can have responses like this. But in gap quantum systems, gap quantum many-body systems, the only kind of response you get are these topological responses. And usually the coefficients of these topological responses are quantized. And so the values of those discrete quantized coefficients distinguish different topological phases in matter, because these coefficients are discrete. So really, you have to go through a phase transition if you want to change the value of this coefficient. Yeah, so quantized topological responses characterize, at least for unfractionalized topological phases of matter. Fractionalized topological phases of matter is, you know, a more complicated story. And so I wanted to explain why this coefficient M, which remember is basically the Hall conductance, is quantized. And so there's this argument, famous argument by Laughlin. If you just talk about Laughlin argument, then at least in condensed metaphysics, everybody will know what you're talking about. So I will give a slight variant on this argument, not the one that Laughlin originally gave, not exactly the same, but it's in a similar kind of spirit. So the argument basically is that I'm going to put some magnetic flux in the system. I guess for the integer quantum Hall effect, it was already a magnetic field, but here I mean like add some excess magnetic field on top of that. And so I'm going to do that magnetic field in a specially varying way. So it's kind of localized in some region, and so there's some net magnetic flux in that region. And I assume that the magnetic field is very slowly varying, so we're probing a very long wavelength response to the system. And so there's this relationship between the charge density and the magnetic field, which kind of holds at every point in space. Now I can integrate over space. I get a relation between the charge and the flux, the magnetic flux, that's proportional to this coefficient M. If the flux is an integer multiple of 2 pi, I claim that the charge has to be an integer. The reason for that is that if you have a 2 pi flux, then it's kind of a localized excitation in the sense that I defined it earlier in the talk. If it was a not 2 pi, then you could detect it far away from the Arnold Bohm effect. But here, it's if it's just a 2 pi flux, it's really a localized excitation. And then by definition, unfractionalized topological phase, this localized excitation cannot be fractionalized. And so if it's not fractionalized, it must have integer charge. So the conclusion from this argument is that this coefficient of a response has to be an integer. If it was an unfractionalized topological phase, you could have other stuff going on. Like, for example, this fractional quantum Hall effect actually has a fractional Hall conductance as well. But an unfractionalized topological phase for response coefficient is quantized to an integer. And so now you can distinguish different topological phases of matter by their Hall conductance, which is this response coefficient. And one thing just to mention is that you can also think of this response as being generated by a topological term for the electromagnetic field. So there's no dynamical degrees of freedom at low temperatures, which is a regime we're considering. But so you can basically, in terms of the language of actions, you can basically integrate out everything. And the only thing that's left is the background electromagnetic field that you've applied. But you can generate a topological term for that background electromagnetic field. In this case, it would be this Chern-Simons action. And so there's a gauge invariance argument for why the Chern-Simons action has a quantized coefficient. And then in particular, if you compute the current, which is a functional derivative of the action respect to the vector potential, that's the maybe the most general way to define the current, then you indeed recover this response equation. So it's kind of equivalent to think about characterizing topological phases either through topological responses or through the topological terms that appear for background fields. But I will mainly just talk about the topological responses directly. So now I want to talk about crystals. Specifically, I want to talk about topological responses in crystals. So the presentation here will follow this paper I wrote with my collaborators here. I say presentation follows because I'm not claiming originality of these ideas. Most or possibly all of what I'm about to say maybe was already known, but I do like the way that we presented in this paper, so I will follow that. But I'm making no claims of originality. I should probably stress that. So the question is, are the topological responses just specific to crystals? So a crystal, of course, is some material or some system with a discrete translation symmetry. In other words, you build up the system from a unit cell, and then you just repeat the unit cell periodically, and that defines the whole system. So you have this discrete translation symmetry. And now you can ask the question, are there topological responses that are specific to crystals? And if there are such topological responses, that will characterize crystalline topological phases of matter. So there'll be topological phases of matter that are distinct from each other, at least in the presence of this discrete translation symmetry. So obviously the answer is going to be yes, otherwise I wouldn't have asked. But maybe we should I should answer the question first, responses to what? In the integer quantum Hall effect that I described previously, I talked about responses to electromagnetic field. But electromagnetic field is not something that's specific to crystals. So those responses are not specific to crystals. So what would be a topological response that would be specific to crystals? And the answer is there's a response to an elastic deformation of the system. So when I have a crystal, I can introduce some deformation into the crystal, where the unit cell is getting stretched out or compressed as a function of space and time. And that's what I call an elastic deformation, or in a quantum language, I guess you would call it phonons. And so it's the responses to this kind of deformation that will characterize responses that are specific to crystals. And so let me talk about the 1D case to make things simple. So here's a crystal in 1D, but it has some elastic deformation. So it's been stretched out and compressed, stretched out here and compressed over here. So to characterize this, I'm going to introduce a field, which I call the elasticity field. Basically the rule for defining the elasticity field is that as you go from as you go from one unit cell to the next unit cell, the elasticity field has to wind by 2 pi. So that this compression and stretched out pattern, in this case, would get encoded into the elasticity field in this way. I don't really care about exactly how theta winds within one unit cell. I mean, I just impose that it has to wind by 2 pi. Really, I want to consider only very long wavelength deformations. So we just say that on long length scales, theta varies in some smooth way. And you don't worry too much about what happens at very short length scales on the order of the lattice spacing. Okay, so that's the elasticity field. The point is that we can now define using this elasticity field topological responses. So let's suppose that as in the integer quantum Hall effect I discussed previously, we have some global U1 symmetry. So then there's an associated current with that. Then I claim that we can have a topological response that involves the elastic field. And so it'll look like this. It's an equation you can write. So notice, first of all, this equation, like the integer quantum Hall response equation, is topological. It doesn't depend on the metric at all, and it's diffeomorphism invariant. The coefficient is also quantized, but I'll come back to why that has to be true later on. So in a gapped quantum many-body system that's a crystal, it could be characterized by a topological response like this. So let's try and figure out what it really means physically to have a response like this. Firstly, we can separate this equation out into components. So the charge density is proportional to the spatial derivative of the elasticity field, and the current in space is proportional to the time derivative of the elasticity field. So what does that mean? So there's a nice picture, a classical picture of it in terms of charges bound to unit cells. So here is our 1D crystal, and I've put in some kind of elastic deformation into it. Now imagine that we have point charges bound to the unit cell. So each unit cell contains a point charge. Now, because it's a U1 symmetry that we're talking about, so you have quantization of charge. So the point charges have to have some integer charge, which I'll call M. So now we can start to understand these equations. So this equation, as I maybe mentioned before, holds only for when you average out over sufficiently long length scales. The point is that if you vary dx theta, it's like you're stretching or compressing the unit cell. And because each unit cell contains charge m, if you compress a unit cell, the charge is the same, but the volume it occupies is different. So the density, the average density of charge is changing as you vary dx theta. And you can convince yourself that indeed this is exactly the right equation. And similarly, if you have a time derivative theta, it kind of means that the unit cells are actually moving as a function of time. And because the charge is a bound to the unit cells, as the unit cells move, they carry this charge with them, and that leads to a net current of charge. So indeed, this is exactly the right equation to describe this classical picture of charges bound to unit cells. Of course, we don't want to consider only this classical picture. Maybe these charges are electrons, and the U1 symmetry is conservation of electron number, but electrons are not point particles, they're quantum mechanical particles, their positions fluctuate, they interact with each other. So this point particle picture would definitely not be, in general, the correct one. The point is that as long as the system is gapped, then for any gap system, it can have topological responses, and in particular, it can have a topological response that looks like this. And so even if you, no matter how much these electrons or whatever charges are fluctuating, you can still have this topological response, and the coefficient of the topological response is still quantized, as I will explain in a minute. So therefore, you still have this integer that characterizes the phase, and roughly you can interpret it as the charge per unit cell. Although you don't have this nice classical picture for it anymore. It's really, rigorously, you would define it in terms of the response of a system to very long wavelength deformations. And so let me explain now why the charge per unit, why this invariant is quantized. It's a very similar argument to what I gave you for the quantum Hall effect earlier on. So the idea is I'm going to introduce a kink. So remember, we're talking about 1D systems here. So this red line, you can think of it as the configuration of this velocity field in the ground state. So it's just a straight line. But then I'm going to introduce a kink. And the property of the kink is that relative to the ground state configuration, the velocity field winds by 2 pi as you go from minus infinity to infinity. And so I always want to consider only long wavelength deformations, so this winding process will happen over a very long length scale. Now, this theta elasticity field is kind of 2 pi periodic, because shifting theta by 2 pi is kind of like translating the system by 1 unit cell, but because you have this discrete translation symmetry, that's the same as not translating the system. So on the right over here, there's really no difference between what you see in this kink configuration and the ground state. The kink really lives only in some localized region. And we can compute the charge associated with the kink by just integrating, because we know from the previous discussion that there's a relation between the charge density and the gradient of the elasticity field. So therefore, you can compute the charge of the kink, and you see, because the kink has winding number 1, and the integral of dx theta is the winding number, the conclusion is that the charge of the kink is just proportional to this topological invariant M. On the other hand, because the kink defect is a localized excitation, as before, in an unfranchised topological phase, the kink defect has to carry integer charge. And so the conclusion is that this topological invariant M is quantized to be an integer, at least in an unfranchised topological phase. In a fractionalized topological phase, you can have this kink could bind a fractionalized particle, and then you could have fractional charge per unit cell. But here, for unfractionalized topological phases, it has to be an integer. So it's a similar story generalizing to higher dimensions. So in 2D case, for example, to parameterize the elasticity, we'd introduce 2 elasticity fields, theta 1 and theta 2. It's kind of hard to draw a picture of what it would look like to the definition, but you can maybe just visualize it. It's an analogous definition in 2D to what we did in 1D. And then we can to talk about the topological response. And again, you have this topological response that has a quantized coefficient that you can again interpret as the charge per unit cell in 2D. But this in 2D, there's a nice application of this topological response you can discuss, which is to the properties of dislocations. So dislocation is a particular kind of topological defect you can introduce in a crystal. So here's a picture of a dislocation. So obviously something singular is going on in this point here, marked in red, that's a dislocation core, but it's a topological defect in the sense that you can still detect the presence of this defect even very far away from the dislocation core. And so the way you would do that is that, for example, you start over here, then you translate by 5 unit cells to the right, and then 5 up, 5 to the left, 5 down. And if there was no topological defect, then you would just come back to the same point under such a process. But here you see in representative dislocation, you're not coming back to the same point. You've actually been translated by some vector. And that vector is what we call the Burgess vector, which is basically the topological charge of this dislocation. And so now let's talk about mobility of dislocation. So we can talk about trying to move this dislocation around. So let's suppose we want to move it, suppose we want to move it like this. This is moving the dislocation horizontally, which is projection parallel to the Burgess vector in this case. You see that's really easy actually, because it's just some local rearrangement of the atoms. Just moving the dislocation. But now suppose we want to move in the vertical direction. Well, it kind of looks not that hard either. It would be something like this. And again, it looks like just some local rearrangement of the atoms, except that if you look carefully, if you look at this atom, which I've labeled in blue here, as I move the dislocation up, the atom actually disappears. So if the number of atoms is a conserved quantity in the system, which you know usually it would be, that means that this process is forbidden by conservation of that charge of the number of atoms. But this is a very classical picture. It's just based on this picture of atoms occupying points. The point of these topological responses is that you can actually discuss this effect without having to assume that the particles are just point particles. So whenever you have a global U1 symmetry, could be conservation of number of atoms or conservation number of electrons or whatever you want, then you can define the corresponding topological invariant involving the topological response of the current to the elastic fields. And then what you find is that if this topological invariant was quantized for integers, but if it's non-zero, then the dislocations can only move in the direction of a Burgess vector without violating conservation of charge. And that's, you know, even beyond this classical picture, that's still true. And you can derive that from the topological response of the system. So remember, in 2D, you have this topological response that relates the electric current or what's the current of whatever the conserved charge is, the current to the elasticity field. Now, if you compute d mu to j mu, that's the continuity equation. And if d mu j mu is non-zero, that's telling you that charge is non-conserved. So now what you find is that if you take a dislocation, which you can think of basically as a vortex of these theta fields, the elastic fields I introduced, that they wind by 2 pi as you go around the dislocation. If you compute d mu j mu, normally it would be zero, which is telling you that charge is conserved. But if you have a dislocation and it's moving in the wrong direction, you actually find that d mu j mu is non-zero. So that's what tells you in a completely general way that dislocations can only move in the direction of that Burgess vector. It's protected by the conservation of charge. Okay, so that's a nice application of these topological responses. So you can do a similar thing also in 3D. Again, this is topological invariant corresponding to charge per unit. So there's actually another interesting response you can have in 3D. So this is a free spatial dimensions, 3+1 space-time. So you say we always assuming a global U1 symmetry. So there's a different kind of topological response you can have that looks like this. So here the current is also proportional to the background of the electromagnetic field. If you deleted this dk theta I, this response basically would look like the response of a 2D integer quantum Hall effect that I mentioned earlier. But here we're in 3D, and so the physical picture basically is that you've taken these 2D integer quantum Hall states and stacked them in the third dimension to make a 3D state. You can verify that such a state indeed would have a response that looks like this. But again, because once you define things in terms of these topological responses, it's not necessary to consider just this decoupled limit. You can couple these 2D states together and make some non-trivial 3D state. But as long as the system remains gapped, this invariant is still well defined. It's basically Hall conductance per layer of the system.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
So here, the U1 symmetry is important.
Yes.
So there were some works on elasticity black tone duality, which they talked about something similar to the previous slide, right? But do they assume the U1 symmetry?
I mean, well, for the dislocation properties, you do need to assume the U1 symmetry. In those works, it's a little unclear exactly where it comes in. I've always been a little bit confused about that. I'm not hugely familiar with exactly what they were doing in those papers. But I mean, the physical statement definitely is that you need the U1 symmetry for the dislocation mobility. The disclination mobility, which I think was also considered in those papers, does not require the U1 symmetry.
Okay, thanks.
So now I want to move on and discuss the topological responses in quasi-crystals. And this will tell us about topological phases of matter that can occur in quasi-crystals. Okay, so firstly, I should say what a quasi-crystal is. So remember, crystals were defined by the fact that they have this discrete translation symmetry. But another way to think about crystals is in terms of a Fourier transform. So you take some observable like density or something, you take a Fourier transform of that observable. For a crystal, you'll see that you have these sharp peaks, which indeed for an infinite system would become just tilde function peaks. Of course, this Fourier transform is really what you probe in, for example, an X-ray diffraction experiment, which is actually how we were able to learn about the structure of crystals even long before we have a technology to actually directly image the crystals in real space. And of course, these sharp peaks are related to the periodicity of the crystal. But then in the 1980s, people started doing X-ray diffraction experiments on some other materials, and they found some very curious properties. So the Fourier transform of these materials, for example, it could look something like this. This is not an experimental picture, but theoretically, the experimental pictures will reflect the fact that the Fourier transform looks something like this. And so there's something funny about this because it has an eightfold rotation symmetry. Well, firstly, the peaks are not kind of regularly spaced like they were in the crystal, but also the peaks are arranged in this eightfold symmetric way, which is weird because a crystal cannot have an eightfold rotation symmetry. Like you can do it as a, look up in the textbooks or the general classification of crystals and what kind of point group symmetries are allowed. Eightfold rotation symmetry is not allowed. So then it was very mysterious, how can you get these kind of Fourier transform patterns from a material. Okay, so that was the mystery, but now, of course, it's well understood. There are these quasi-crystal materials that give you these Fourier transform patterns like this. And for example, this particular Fourier transform is actually what I generated from a tiling that looks like this. So this is called the Amann-Binka tiling. Maybe you're more familiar with a more famous version, which is a Penrose tiling. That would give you a five-fold rotation symmetry. But anyway, this is the version with an eight-fold rotation symmetry. And you're filling space with these tiles. But there's some rule that you impose that ensures that actually the tile pattern never actually repeats. I mean, of course, there's some local patterns that repeat. As you can see, this star pattern is repeating. But globally, there's no translation symmetry. There's no exact periodicity. So you can continue this pattern forever, it will never repeat. That's kind of the definition of a quasi-crystal. And quasi-crystals do, however, have this sharp peaks in the Fourier transform, because even though there's no exact periodicity, there's enough sort of approximate periodicity to give you these sharp peaks. But they're allowed to have these non-crystallographic point group symmetries that would never be allowed in a crystal like this eightfold rotation symmetry. But I do want to stress that having a non-crystallographic point group symmetry is not the definition of a quasi-crystal. Maybe there's some confusion about this. The definition of a quasi-crystal is it's some structure that has a sharp peaks in the Fourier transform, but that cannot be analyzed just as being a crystal. So such a structure can have a non-crystallographic point group symmetry like eightfold, but it doesn't have to have that. Anyway, so these quasi-crystal materials exist in the real world. And so now we can start to think about what kind of topological phases can be hosted in these quasi-crystals. In particular, are there topological responses that are related to the quasi-crystal entity? And so to answer that, we need to think again about the elastic modes as we did for the crystal. So in a 1D crystal, you have the elastic mode, which remember was parameterized by this phase angle field. As I mentioned earlier, this field is really 2 pi periodic as a consequence of the translation symmetry, the discrete translation symmetry by one unit cell. So because it's periodic, you can think of this field as living on the circle if you want. It turns out that the elastic modes of a quasicrystal in 1D are parameterized by more data than this. Actually, the elastic field lives on a d-dimensional torus now, so some number capital D greater than the physical dimension of one. And so here is a two-dimensional torus. So imagine that I identify the top and bottom and left and right, so that it wraps around into a torus. And so this elasticity field lives on this torus, and there's two directions that you can move along the torus. In other words, there's two ways to, for a crystal, we can just basically translate it in space, and so there's one way to shift the elastic field. But for a quasicrystal, there's actually two different ways you can quote unquote shift it. There's one direction which is just corresponds to globally translating the system, which is similar to what would happen in a crystal. And in this picture, it basically corresponds to moving in this direction along the torus. But actually, because this angle is kind of incommensurate, as you keep translating and translating the system in space, you end up throwing densely this torus. You never actually come back to the same point. And that's reflecting the fact that unlike a crystal, which has a discrete translation symmetry, 1D quasicrystals do not have any exact translation symmetry. But you can also move shift of theta in the perpendicular direction. That corresponds to a different kind of elastic mode that we call phasons, whereas the conventional elastic mode would be phonons. And so the interesting thing about this from a point of view of this talk is that now you can use these elastic modes to think about topological responses. And so whereas in a 1D quasicrystal, we have a topological response that looks like this. In a 1D quasicrystal, because you have more elastic fields, then you have more, turns out, integer valued invariants that parameterize these topological terms. So instead of having topological phases characterized by a single integer, you have a topological phase characterized by d independent integers. So again, this is defined in any gap system because of a general story about topological responses, any gap system that's quasicrystal. Let me give you now the physical picture that's kind of analogous to this point charge description I have for crystals. So remember, a crystal you get just by repeating the unit cell in some periodic way, and then you can have a charge bound to each unit cell. That was this point charge picture. So the quasicrystals are sort of analogous, except that you don't have just one unit cell. There's different kinds of tiles. If you think about a tiling construction of a quasicrystal, there's different kinds of tiles. In this particular picture, there's actually 6 different kinds of tiles. So any tile that appears in this picture can be related by translations back to one of these 6 prototiles. And I don't impose any point group rotation symmetry here. So like this one and this one would be inequivalent. So there's 6 different kinds of tiles. Now the idea is that I can bind a charge to these tiles, but for each tile I have a choice. I can choose independently how much charge I want to bind to each tile. So in this case, rather than a single charge per unit cell invariant, I actually have 6 independent integers because I can decide how much charge I want to bind to each tile. And so you can also have analogs of this. For example, I talked about this 3D state that you get by stacking 2D integer quantum Hall. That was the crystalline picture, but for quasicrystal, you can stack them in more like independent ways that are associated with the tiles. And so all these crystalline topological phases can generalize in an interesting way to quasicrystals. This is just this picture of for each tile. It can belong to one of 6 types indicated by these colors, and then you can choose how much charge you want to assign for each type of tile. And so an application for this, for example, would be for dislocations in quasicrystals. So it turns out quasicrystals also have these topological defects called dislocations. You can think of them as vortices of the theta field. In other words, for this elastic field that I defined, which are 2 pi periodic, they wind by 2 pi as you go around the dislocation. But it's sort of not very obvious just from looking at it, what's going on. I wanted to include a picture of a dislocation at Quasicrystal I found in a book, but then I thought since this talk is recorded, I don't know, maybe I'm violating copyright if I just steal it from a book. But in any case, it's not that illuminating. You can't really look at a picture of a dislocation in a quasicrystal and really see even that it's singular, or let alone see like, you know, what the analog of the Burgers vector would be. And so specifically, if you want to talk about how do dislocations move in space, it would be very hard to look at those pictures and work it out. But this topological response story is letting you address that, because you just look at this topological response, it describes the long wavelength properties of the system, and then you'll see which directions can dislocations move while violating conservation, well, which directions can they move while preserving conservation of charge, and which directions are forbidden by conservation of charge. And it's related to these values of these topological invariants of the phase of matter. So generally, it turns out that it's still like one direction for 2D dislocation of 2D quasicrystals. It's still usually one direction that it can move in, and you can write down a precise formula from this topological response of what, which direction that is. You can't really say just that they move only along the direction of the Burgers vector, because Burgers vector lives in a high dimensional space. But anyway, there's some formula that you can derive for that. So now I want to go further. So far, I've kind of only told you about topological phases that are related to translation symmetry, or at least for crystals, I talked about translation symmetry, discrete translation symmetry. For quasicrystals, they don't really have discrete translation symmetry, but it's some kind of translational structure that is being explored. But of course, crystals can have other symmetries as well. So a crystal can have a point group symmetry. Here, for example, we have a 90-degree rotation symmetry about some point. You can rotate by 90 degrees and a crystal has that symmetry. And so you can also have topological responses that are related to these point group symmetries. I won't go the whole distance and write down the topological terms like I did in the other case, but I'll just talk about a physical manifestation of these topological responses, which is that let's consider a disclination defect. So a disclination defect is like a dislocation, you go around the defect core, and you get translated by one lattice cell. So you get translated by some translation. A disclination, like you go around the defect core, and it's as if you're getting rotated by some angle. Here, if you sort of go around the defect core while trying to, you know, maintain the orientation of your where you're looking compared with the lattice vectors, you'll get translated by 90 degrees. And so it's a property of these disclination defects in topological phases that they can carry fractional charge. And this can happen even in an unfractionalized topological phase. If it was a fractionalized topological phase, this would not be surprising in the sense that, even without a disclination, you can have fractional charge in that case. But unfractionalized topological phases, without these disclination defects, all the charges would always be integers. But a disclination defect being a kind of a non-local defect can trap this fractional charge. And so maybe we want to say now the most general case, we want to include both translation symmetry and point group symmetry. And in general, there can be some non-trivial extension between those two. It gives rise to so-called non-somorphic space groups. And then maybe we want to include internal symmetries. I mostly talk about U1 in this case, but you can have different kinds of internal symmetries, like spin rotation symmetry or fermion parity if you have a fermionic system. So you can ask, you know, what is the classification of crystalline topological phases, or equivalently topological responses, in this most general setting. So if you want to discuss a completely general symmetry group and you want to deal with every symmetry group at the same time, necessarily you're going to go to some higher level of mathematical abstraction compared with the physical discussions I've been giving earlier in the talk. But in any case, that's what we tried to do in these papers I wrote with Ryan Fongren. And so there's this nice mathematical answer, which is that the right mathematical framework to understand these things is in terms of equivariant generalized cohomology. So yeah, I don't have time to go through the details of that, but for people with a mathematical bent, maybe that rings a bell and you might like to check out these papers to see how it's related to crystalline topological responses. there was another nice alternative approach that was developed by this group that it actually turns out is equivalent to R1. And then very recently, we were able to extend also to quasi-crystals. And so the most general classification of topological phases in quasi-crystals of translation structure, rotational symmetry structure, etc. Yes, so that brings me maybe towards the end. Future directions I'm interested in, of course, experimental applications. I have always beautiful formal theory, but it would be nice to discuss the experimental implications. And there is a very large literature these days on topological materials. And topological materials would generally have these kind of non-trivial topological responses, but it hasn't really been, well, it hasn't necessarily been thought of in that way very much. So it would be nice to think about how to explore these topological responses of topological materials experimentally. And also generally topological phases of matter in this, from an experimental point of view, have tended to be discussed for where you have systems of electrons that are non-interacting. So you have some topology associated with a band structure of non-interacting electrons. So these things can have interesting topological responses, but the topological responses are not dependent on the non-interacting nature of the system. So it would be nice to push beyond just non-interacting systems and go to maybe even strongly interacting systems and explore topological phases and topological responses in those settings. And finally, I'm also interested in metals and quasicrystals. So I've talked about in this talk mainly gap systems. Metal is a gapless system, but there's a lot of interesting topology associated with gapless systems and specifically metals. Some of you might remember from the talk I gave earlier this year at Perimeter, which I guess was my faculty job talk. There I actually talked a lot about the topological aspects of metals. In that talk, I just talked about crystals, but I think there's probably a lot of interesting things going on in quasi-crystals as well. So that's a direction I would like to go in. Yeah, so that brings me to the end. Here is a big picture of a quasi-crystal. You can stare at it and check that it never repeats if you like. But yeah, thanks for listening.
Okay, yeah, feel free to unmute and or not and applaud, yeah, one way or another. Thank you, Dominic, for a great talk. Can I start by asking if there are any questions from students? Or while the students are plotting their questions, are there any questions from non-students?
I have a question.
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, so are all quasicrystals fully classified?
What do you mean by classified?
In the same sense as crystals or space groups are classified.
Yeah, I think so. Well, okay. I'm not sure. There's a precise definition of like equivalent of what a space group is for a quasi crystal, but whether such things have been fully classified, I'm actually not sure. Maybe somebody else knows.
What I really want to ask is, for the topological response theory of quasi crystals you presented, how general is it?
Well, it's totally general. You can take a general space group. We have a mathematical framework, and then you say in that mathematical framework, maybe you have to compute stuff. If you want to give me a specific space group, I have to do some mathematical computation. So I'm not claiming that I can always do that computation, but at least for the mathematical, the translating it from the physics into a mathematical problem, I think that's well defined for any space group.
So for quasicrystals, suppose it doesn't involve any point group symmetry, but it involves some U1 symmetry, then the statement is the topological response term you presented before is the most general and complete form.
Plus like for ones that are like related to, you know, stacking integer quantum Hall.
Yeah.
And then I guess as you probably know, there are gravitational responses as well, but I didn't want to get into that.
Okay, thanks.
Maybe while we're waiting for other questions to bubble up, but could I ask, so the sense in which your results about quasicrystals, the thing that which is characteristic of them is that they have this phase, which is a number of phases which are larger than the number of spatial dimensions, right? The number of thetas is larger than the number of spatial dimensions.
Right.
Does it have to be an integer multiple of the number of spatial dimensions, or can it just be any integer?
No, it doesn't have to be an integer multiple. In many cases, it seems like it is. I think often, like for 2D quasicrystals, the number of phases is 4, but there's no fundamental restriction, I think, that that is to be true.
Yeah. Right. Normally, if it has a non-crystallographic symmetry, like eightfold, like you were saying, or 12-fold, then it has to be, there's a certain integer multiple related to the integer level of the irrationality of that particular symmetry group.
Yeah, that may be true, but since I'm not defining quasicrystals in terms of the non-crystallographic symmetries, I think that this shouldn't be any restriction.
Okay. Maybe I'll just ask one other question. So the dislocation defects you were talking about in quasicrystals, are those what are sometimes called decapod defects in the Penrose tiling case? These are these sort of unfillable holes in the tiling that you can't fill while satisfying the rules of the tiling? Or is that a different?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that terminology, so.
But is what you mean by a dislocation defect in the quasicrystal case like a patch of the tiling that can't be consistently filled over without satisfying the rules?
Maybe that's a consequence. I mean, it's a topological defect, so it should be something you can see like very far away. So from my point of view, it's like for this field that defines the phonons and phasons as a winding number, but maybe it implies what you're saying.
Yeah, it sounds like the same thing. Okay. Thank you. Well, let's see. Are there any final questions?
Hi, Dominic.
Yeah,
is it possible to have lattice symmetry fractionalization without global symmetry fractionalization?
Lattice symmetry fractionalization.
Yeah, just fractionalize lattice symmetry, similar to.
Yeah. I mean, that's definitely possible. So if you have a fractionalized topological phase.
Usually for a fractionalized topological phase, right, I can understand that lattice symmetry is also fractionalized. Right? I'm curious that, is it possible to have a phase without global symmetry fractionalization, but the lattice symmetry is fractionalized?
So to be clear, when I said fractionalized topological phase, I just mean a non-invertible topological phase. I didn't mean that there's a symmetry fractionalization. So in a non-invertible topological phase, you can have lattice symmetry fractionalization. It doesn't have to be related to global symmetry fractionalization. I mean, those are independent.
Okay, yeah, thanks.
Any last questions? If not, let's thank Dominic one more time for a great talk.